Hello, everybody. I'm Mickey Thomas, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. Built this city.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself. I can't afford to be. This is small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away. A song away. A song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the release of his two-sided holiday single, A Classic Christmas, please welcome singer Mickey Thomas. Mickey, hello.
Hello, how are you, Pat?
I am great. I am so excited to talk to you today because I've been trying for years to get you on the show, and I'm so happy that you're finally here in front of me.
Oh, great. Well, I'm happy to be here.
My first question is, you've been making music for 5 decades. What took you so long to record some Christmas music?
That's a good question, because I wanted to do it for a long time. I guess it was just a question of being able to get all the elements to come together at the right time and pull it off and get it done. And it helped. My manager really helped a lot to put it together for me. He's good friends with Danny Frizzell, who produced it in Nashville and put all the musicians together for us. So they made it easy for me. All I had to do was pick the songs I wanted to do and just show up and sing and enjoy the session.
And did you fly down to Nashville? You recorded it in Nashville?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
All right. Because, you know, since COVID, sometimes people record their vocal here, send it there. But you're saying this was all recorded together?
Yes, it was. I really wanted to do it that way. As you mentioned, you know, quite often this day and age, not only do we not have to be in the same room together, we don't have to be in the same country together to record together sometimes. But in this situation, I felt it was kind of important to be in the room together, you know, creating the music together, looking at each other in the eye and reading each other and tweaking arrangements as we were doing it. And so it was really a fun process. The guys were great session musicians and not only great players, but they were all really funny too. So we had a blast doing it. But I really wanted that old school kind of session. You know, the vocals are pretty much live as we were cutting the tracks. And, you know, I wanted it to be the way, you know, Frank and Tony and Jack Jones or Andy Williams would do it. You know?
Well, you pulled it off, because these two tracks are excellent. I never know what I'm going to get when one of my legacy artists records some Christmas music, but I can honestly say that you hit it out of the park with these two singles. The first one is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Now, do you have a favorite version of that song other than own?
Yes. It was the original version. Judy Garland is the one that I tried to create more of the atmosphere of that version than a lot of the other renditions of that song, because it's sort of a melancholy moment. It's from the movies, Meet Me in St. Louis, which is an old film from the 30s. And so the song was written for that movie and for Judy. And she's kind of, you know, standing in the windowsill, looking out through the window with her little sister, you know, looking with, you know, standing there with her and looking out. They're looking out the window together. And it's kind of a moment of where they know the families are going to be separated for Christmas. So she's trying to make her little sister feel a little better about that and say, yeah, I know, you know, but someday soon we'll all be together again and everything will be great. And so it's sort of melancholy, but it's also very hopeful at the same time.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay.
Mickey, when you go into a project like this, other than your distinctive voice, do you have a plan for how you're going to put your own stamp on this? Do you want to do it the traditional way, which I find that you did, or were people saying, you got to make it your own, you got to make it modern? What was your take going into it?
Yeah. Well, I definitely didn't want to make it modern. I wanted it to be traditional, classic sounding Christmas. And, I, you know, because I'm kind of that kind of singer anyway, a part of me is, you know, I've always wanted to do, I mean, I walk around the house all the time singing the songs that I heard my mom and dad sing when I was a little kid, you know, songs from that era, from the 50s and stuff. And so I wanted to make it like that. I definitely didn't want it to, I didn't want to rock it up, you know. I'm not really a big fan of like, you know, rock and roll Christmas songs, you know, run, run, Rudolph. I don't really, I mean, it's okay, but it's just not my cup of tea. So I really wanted to just make it very intimate and classic. And as I said, I'm kind of a crooner at heart anyway. So I felt that I could pull it off and make it a traditional classic Christmas, but without compromising my voice or what I do, and that it would feel natural for me singing it that way. And I think it worked.
It worked. I'm like you. I love the traditional albums. I love Nat King Cole's Christmas album, and I love Bing Crosby. That's the stuff that takes me back to my childhood and what my parents also listened to.
Exactly. I wanted to capture that because, you know, those songs that do take us back to our childhood, to a happier time, you know, warm moments and happy moments when we were younger, when we were kids, and how magical Christmas was for us back then, it can take us back to that moment. It's kind of like, I think that Christmas songs like that can sort of short circuit a lot of the bad vibes that, you know, go to our brain and make us feel bad and, you know, put up a roadblock and say, nope, none of that. We're just going to have the warm, nostalgic feelings here.
Well, Christmas music, it should make you feel happy. If it's making you feel sad, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, but, exactly.
I want to let people know A Classic Christmas will be available on all digital platforms December 1st. And before I forget, let me tell you where we can find all things about Mickey Thomas. Website is starshipcontrol.com. Twitter is at starshipcontrol or at Mickey_Thomas. And on Instagram, at starship_control. Now, the second song of the two is It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. And I believe that's an Andy Williams one is the one I remember.
Oh, yeah. Andy Williams had the definitive version of that song. So I think I wanted to be kind of true to the Andy Williams arrangement and the spirit and the vibe of that song. We don't have all the background singers and dancers that Andy had in his version, but I wanted to just capture that vibe. And again, this is sort of like, you know, the flip side. I wanted to balance, as I mentioned, the sort of melancholy nature of having yourself with something that would be more uplifting. And it's something, you know, it's kind of like every Christmas cliche that you could think of is sort of in that song.
Yes.
All the really great, wonderful things about Christmas that we associate with it.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year. It's the happiest season of all. With those holiday greetings and gay happy meetings when friends come to call.
And Mickey, what part of the country do you live in currently?
Right now, I live in Rancho Mirage, California, right next door to Palm Springs.
Now, it's not very Christmassy there in the winter. It's still pretty warm. You're not getting any snow there.
No, we won't. It's still, it's not very Christmassy in general, but you know, we try to make the most of it. Christmas in the desert. And as I mentioned, we make our home look very, very Christmassy in the traditional sense. My wife's a great decorator. And so our home if you walked in their home, you wouldn't know you were in the desert. You might think you were in Connecticut or something, you know?
Yeah, just turn the air conditioner way up and no one will know.
Right.
I guess my next question is, these two songs are so good. And look, I'm not just saying that, folks. You know me. If I didn't think they were good, I would skirt around the issue. I wouldn't tell Mickey they were good. But these songs are fantastic. It makes me want to know if there will be a full-length Christmas album down the road.
Well, yes, that is the plan. You know, we thought we would test the waters with these two songs. And if we get a good reaction and if people want more, then the plan is to, over the course of next year, we'll put together a whole album of Christmas songs, pretty much, I think, in the same vein as what I've done here. And then by Christmas 2024, we'd have the whole album ready and ready to go and put it out and possibly do some kind of a Christmas tour at that point in time with, you know, all the Christmas songs. And of course, throw in a Starship, Jefferson Starship, and other things in it as well.
Well, again, I've heard some of your contemporaries try their hand at this, and they are not doing it as well as you did it with these two songs. I was just blown away because I really didn't know what to expect, and so pleased. And these are definitely in my Christmas playlist rotation for 2023 and onward. Five decades making music. Lots of rockers are releasing autobiographies. Have you started to write your autobiography yet, Mickey?
I have not started to write it. We have started shooting a documentary about my career.
Okay.
We filmed some stuff. It's kind of on hiatus right now while we get some other things cleared up and out of the way. But we are doing that. And that, when I started doing that, that kind of inspired me to at least think about doing some writing about my life, my career, and do something autobiographical. If I could just focus long enough to sit down and start doing it, you know, I get kind of scattered. I get a lot of things going on at once, and I just need to focus and take the time to do it, because usually if I'm laying awake at night with insomnia, you know, I'm starting to write it, and I get all the good ideas in, but then you wake up the next morning, you're like, what was I thinking? Wait a minute, I had it all together and now it's gone again, you know.
You got to start talking into your phone at night.
Yeah, that's it.
Fooled Around and Fell in Love. I'm one of the many, many, many people that did not know you were the singer on that song. I didn't know it for many, many years. And when I found that out, I was kind of blown away, because the song is credited to Elvin Bishop, but you were the singer for his band. What was it like for you to know that this song was given new life on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack? I mean, kids know this song now, you know, little kids, teenagers, they all know the song now.
Yeah, the song, you know, it had appeared in many, many movies over the years, but that was the one that truly did introduce it to a new younger audience, a new generation of listeners. I remember, my son, he's 27 now, but when that first came out, I guess he was about 18 or 19 or something. And he going to the movies with friends, all his friends of his age, and it came on, you know, in the movie, and he goes, "That's my dad." And they were like, "What? Really?" So it made some points for him. But you're right, it reached a new audience, and it also came at a really a nice little moment in the film where it happens too, you know, the romantic first kiss. And so, yeah, that was great. You know, it kind of was quite a change of pace for a lot of the movies that the song had appeared in over the years, like Boogie Nights and Summer of Sam and the Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, this is much better to be included in Guardians of the Galaxy, a family film.
It was in a good Christmas movie too. Family Stone, was that the one that was, I don't know if you ever saw that one, but that was a really good Christmas movie. And it appears in that film too at a really dynamic moment in the movie with Claire Danes and Dermot Mulroney.
Oh, okay.
And it's, they're kind of falling in love and dancing and their first kiss, and it's coming out of the jukebox in the bar while they're dancing.
Very nice.
That's a good Christmas movie, by the way, if you haven't checked it out.
All right. Well, we're talking a little bit about Christmas, so we'll definitely check that one out. When this song or any of your songs are going to be on a soundtrack, do you know that in advance? Do you know how it might be used in the film, or are you just as surprised as everyone else?
I usually am surprised as everyone else this day and age, because sometimes I don't really hear about it until it happens. You know, back in the 80s when we were like recording songs specifically for movies, of course, you know, we knew about it in advance then, obviously, and we were, you know, more involved in that process. But now, you know, sometimes like We Built This City or Nothing's Gonna Stop Us or Fooled Around will just pop up in a movie or a TV commercial or something. And excuse me, because for those two, even though they were kind of my biggest hits, or those three, I didn't write any of them. Yeah. So it's usually the writers who have to give clearance for something to appear in a movie or a commercial or TV show or something.
But because you sing those songs, I'm hoping a little mailbox money comes your way.
Yeah, a little bit filters in every now and then. And plus, it just gives anything that gives those songs more exposure. Helped me a lot as far as my live performance and stuff too.
Absolutely. You know,
that always helps.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to 1979, Jefferson Starship, Freedom at Point Zero. This kind of changes your life.
Yeah. It took me in a different direction than what I was planning at that point in time. You know, I just left the Elvin Bishop Band and I was making plans to go to Miami and record a solo album with a great producer, Bill Simzik, who produced Fooled Around and Fell in Love, and as well as so many other classic albums from the 70s. So we were gathering songs and making plans to do that and getting ready to go to Miami. And then I got the call from Jefferson Starship saying, "Hey, we need a singer. Would you be interested?" And I was not expecting that at all. That was a true bolt from the blue.
And not only do they need a singer, Mickey, you're replacing two singers.
Yeah.
You're replacing Marty Ballin and Grace Slick. Yeah. Was there any trepidation on your part that you're going to be the new face and voice of this established band?
Yeah, there was. There was a lot of trepidation because I knew that, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, you know, people are going to be like, "Where's Grace? Where's Marty? Who's this guy? We don't know him." So I knew there was going to be a lot of that. And I did prepare myself mentally for that, but the band made it easier too, in the sense that, at that point in time, the whole situation was Ainsley Dunbar had just come into the band. Yes. So there was a new drummer as well as a new singer. There was a total change of musical direction from, you know, Count on Me and Miracles to coming out of the box with a song like Jane. Really set the tone for the new Jefferson Starship. So there were, and hence, that's how we came up with the whole title of the album, you know, Freedom at Point Zero. Like, we're back at point zero, we're starting all over again, we're redefining things, and let's hope that we'll be accepted on our own terms rather than being compared to the last incarnation of the band. So that helped a little bit.
Just don't.
And then in 1982, Grace decided to rejoin the band, and that helped out as well.
Yeah, when I went back and watched some of the videos from that era on YouTube, and the band just, you guys look great. You are just hard rocking. I love Ainsley Dunbar. You know, he's coming off his gig in Journey. And you guys, like you said, Jane is just a monster hit. I can't think of a better way to introduce the new guys than with Jane. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah. You know, because as I mentioned, when I first went to meet the band, and we're in Paul Kantner's living room, and they start kind of playing me some ideas, you know, and well, this is kind of where we want to go with this. And, you know, we're really looking to change our musical direction, and we want to come out with a much harder sound, harder edge. And we started jamming on Jane. And that was when you just knew right away, you know, you could sense inherently that this is cool. This is something really fresh.
Yeah.
And this could be something. And that was the first song we jammed on. It was the first song we recorded. It was obviously the first single from Freedom at Point Zero, and it debuted at number one on the Hot Album Tracks. So,
and it doesn't hurt to have Ron Nevison producing either.
Not at all. Ron Nevison, brilliant producer. I was just reading something yesterday about Nevison. I was reading something popped up on my Apple News about the formation of Bad Company and when they were first starting out. And, you know, their first album, they didn't really have a producer. They just started jamming and playing and singing. But they had Ron Nevison as an engineer.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
So you're telling me, I just want to be clear, you got the call. There was no audition process. You just got the call to be in the band?
Yeah, there wasn't like a formal audition. Mm-hmm. It was just, hey, come and hang out. And, you know, I was living right across the bridge. I was living in Mill Valley, California. And
okay.
Paul was in San Francisco. And so I just drove over to Paul's house and met the guys, you know, Craig, Pete, David, Ainsley, who was a new guy just like me, and just started talking and jamming and singing. And the next thing I know, we're in the studio recording Freedom at Point Zero with Ron Nevison.
Amazing. So, yeah. But you also owed an album. And is that the album Alive and Alone? You had to do that between. Did that slow down any Jefferson Starship momentum?
No, we just did it right in between Freedom at Point Zero and Modern Times.
All right.
So there was enough break in the action where I went to Miami for a couple of months, and we knocked that out probably from when we started cutting the tracks till we mixed it was only about 2 months.
Well, I love that. I love that album too. And I really dig the song, She's Got You Running.
In the night, as you tear through the streets, looking for your lover, you try to be cool in the heat, but she always gets to you. Try anything that she believes is right for you.
Nice stuff.
I just popped up the other day on something I was listening to out of nowhere. I hadn't heard it in a long time. I just saw, you know, Don Felder plays guitar on all the tracks on that album. And I just ran into Felder a couple of weeks ago too, at a Raiders football game. And we started talking about old times and making Alive Alone and reliving some of the great memories we had from that time.
And was Don on the album because Bill was producing?
Yes, Bill Simms, they put the band together. Obviously, he was at that point in time working with the Eagles.
Yeah.
They just finished the long run. So he got Felder, Joe Vitale on drums, who was from the Joe Walsh band at that point in time, and George Chocolate Perry, a great session bassist in the Miami area who played on any records that were made in Miami. Chocolate was usually playing bass on them. And put together the studio band and recorded it all at Bill's studio there in the Coconut Grove. And It was a blast, man. Great times.
Very nice.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So, Modern Times, Nevison is back. Was Grace Slick, because she's really only on Stranger. She sings lead on Stranger, co-lead with you on Stranger. Was that just going to be a guest spot for Grace, or was the plan to try to coerce her to come back?
Oh, no, we weren't trying to coerce her.
Mm-hmm.
But during the process of recording Modern Times, we were kind of at the tail end of the album, and Stranger was one of the last things that we cut. But Grace had been kind of coming around, hanging out in the studio while we were making that album, and just kind of having fun and checking things out. And she made the comment about, she said, "God, you guys are having so much more fun in the band now than it was like when I left." Because, you know, when she left, it was like everything was crashing and burning. And, you know, it was a soap opera, and there were relationships, internal relationships in the band, and people fighting over each other. And so it was kind of a mess when she had left the band. So to come back and see us functioning the way we were,
yeah,
in such a more of a happy and creative way, she was very impressed by that. And so they invited her, said, "Well, you know, we're cutting Stranger. This could be a duet. You want to jump in and sing it with Mickey?" So she said, yeah. So obviously that was the first thing that we recorded together in the studio. So after that, she said, "You know, this is really fun. Do you think, could you guys use a background vocalist, a female background vocalist?" And we said, "Well, let us think about that." So of course we said, yes.
And had you ever met Grace before?
I'd met her briefly when I was first met the band, when I was at Kantner's house and we were rehearsing in the living room. And she came over and she was kind of hanging out in the kitchen, sort of peeking around the corner and checking it out to see what it sounded like. And then we had a break in rehearsal and went up to the kitchen to get a drink or something. And she was there in the kitchen and she said, "You know, hey, you sing pretty good." I said, "Well, thank you, you know." And typical, you know, Grace Slick form, you know, she said, "Do you make love pretty good too?"
Oh boy.
Except she didn't say make love.
Sure, I know what she said.
And I was kind of taken aback, you know, and I said, "Well, not as good as I sing."
That's a good answer. Yeah. Now, I just want to talk about Stranger for a second. The two of you singing together is just magic. I was listening to it the other day. I had it cranked up. My wife came in the room. She could barely tell where you end and Grace began, yeah, because it's just perfect. I mean, and I want to say that you and Grace for me are underrated in my book as vocalists. I don't think people talk about Grace Slick and Mickey Thomas enough. I just don't.
Yeah.
And you guys are phenomenal.
Yeah, there was a real, the way our voices blended together, there was a real magic there. And, you know, you never know how that's going to go when you try to sing with somebody, but it just worked for some reason. Like you said, sometimes it was like it would mesh into one voice.
Yeah.
And I believe that just in general, Grace is a very underrated singer.
Yeah.
And she was always very self-deprecating as well. She always put herself down and didn't really think that she was a good singer. You know, she was always said, well, I got attitude, but I'm not really a great singer. I said, no, you are. You're a great singer.
Yeah.
You know, you need to own that.
Right.
And so I think she's underrated as a vocalist as well. And, you know, we did some, I mean, I'm so proud of the stuff that we were able to create together all through the 80s. And we had a really good working relationship as well. We got along great. You know, we had, because, you know, when you're on tour, we're on these, you know, 8-hour bus rides. And,
yeah,
you know, you have a lot of time to just kind of sit there and have conversation with somebody and really get to know them. And so that was a great time that we shared together. And, you know, people always say, like, are you going to ever do anything together again? And I go, well, I'm game. And she is, but I don't think she's too motivated to do anything musically now, just involved in her painting.
Yeah, I think she's just chilling out. Classic rock radio also needs to get behind Jefferson Starship and Starship more, because Find Your Way Back, phenomenal.
Yeah.
And Stranger, that bass line, the two guitars and the vocals. I mean, we should be hearing this out of our radios every single day on classic rock radio. We just should.
Yeah, Stranger's a good call. That definitely would kind of fits the classic rock mold
sure
perfectly,
does.
The whole structure of it.
1982, Winds of Change, Kevin Beamish produces. Was Ron not available, or did you guys just want to try someone different?
Ron was not available, and we were kind of under the gun to get the album made, you know, pressure from the label and stuff. So we started looking for other producers, and sure enough, Kevin came along. He was fresh off of, High Infidelity, the REO album, which was a smash. So he seemed like a good fit. So we got in the studio, and we did that one album with Kevin, and it was a good experience. We didn't really... You know, I don't think we had any real hits off of it, or nothing that became a real staple of rock radio or anything. So,
no.
But it was a fun experience, and he was great to work with.
I love the title track. And again, you and Grace sing your asses off on that.
Walk softly through the desert sand, careful where you tread. Underfoot are the visions lost. Sleeping not yet dead. Winds starting to howl. The beast is on the prowl. Can you hear the strange cry? Winds of change are blowing by. Mountains crumble and cities fall. Don't come to an end. Let's get it on the desert floor. Waiting.
And Out of Control is a crazy video that you guys did.
Yeah.
So, and you know what? This is a weird thing to say, but Winds of Change might be my favorite Jefferson Starship album of the four that you did. It's just, I don't know, maybe because it wasn't played as much. And when I discovered it, I felt like it was mine. Like I owned this one. I found this one. So it's great.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting. It was kind of it was sort of a surprise to us, because that was the first full album we did when Grace had returned,
right?
You know, as a full time member of the band again. So we had some pretty high expectations for that album, the return of Grace Slick, and you know, coming off of Jane and Find Your Way Back, and so. But I don't know why. You know, you just never know sometimes in this business, you know, what's going to work, what's not going to work. There's so many elements that go into it: timing, chemistry, where's the label at this point in time, where's radio, where's, you know, there's always a lot of luck involved in everything you do.
There's a lot of components that go into getting a song on the radio and making it a hit. I'm sure some of the greatest songs we've never heard are out there.
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness for deep tracks, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to this day, I'm an album guy. I like to buy the album and listen start to finish. That's how you find that's how you find the nuggets. 1984, Nuclear Furniture, Nevison Returns. And again, two big songs, Laying It on the Line and No Way Out. Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, No Way Out was a really a very commercial hit for us, which was, you know, something that we really needed at that point in time. And that was a real good one. It's also probably the craziest video we ever did, I think, was the No Way Out.
Yes.
It was pretty nuts. We had to make it up on the spot. You know, we had hired this director, and he was a pretty kooky guy. And he, you know, he showed up the day we're supposed to start kind of shooting the video. And we were like, well, what you got? He goes, well, I don't really have anything. I said, well, do you have storyboards or concept or anything? No, we're just going to go over here to the, you know, to the airplane house where we had all of our offices were set up and stuff. And we'll just start shooting. So that's pretty much what we did. I called some people, some friends. I said, I called my friend Don Novello, Father Guido Sarducci.
Yeah.
I said, hey, we're shooting a video. Can you come down and help us out with this? We'll find out for you to do. And then Grace dressed up as the nun with the helmet on. And it was almost like a Fellini movie, you know, that video. But that's one of my favorite videos we ever did.
Yeah. And these things live on YouTube for better or worse. If there's one that you're embarrassed by, it's going to be there too. And if there's one you love, well, there it is. So a year later, Knee Deep in the Hoopla, you and Grace and Craig and Pete, you guys are staying together, but there's a new name. Explain the name change for people who might not know why it became Starship.
You know, we had kind of been toying with the idea for a couple of years of shortening the name to Starship, because generally speaking, everybody at that point in time always referred to the band as Starship anyway.
Okay.
People in radio or fans, or they very rarely would they say Jefferson Starship. They say Starship, the new Starship album, or the Starship tour, or this or that. And so we've been thinking about it. And then when Paul Kantner left the band under not the greatest of circumstances, it was kind of like, from Paul's point of view, it was like, I'm leaving the band, but I'm going to take my ball and go home. So you can't play either.
Okay.
Or you can't use the name either. So then he had some claims that he owned the name Jefferson Starship. And we said, well, anyway, we thought the easiest way to resolve this is, okay, we'll just officially shorten the name of the Starship and we'll retire the name Jefferson Starship forever. So that was what we did at that point in time. So no one was ever supposed to be Jefferson Starship again until about 1992, when Paul got the urge to go back out on the road again and decided he wanted to unretire the name Jefferson Starship.
Right.
So it reappeared then.
But as Starship, you were still allowed to perform live the songs you recorded with Jefferson Starship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Knee Deep in the Hoopla, two number one singles, We Built This City and Sarah. Let's talk about We Built This City. It's no, what do I want to say? How can I say it nicely? This is an often maligned song, Mickey. I don't know I don't know why people use this song as a punchline, because I find it to be joyous and it takes me right back to 1985 whenever I hear it. I love it.
We built this city.
I think it was very, it became sort of the poster child for a lot of things that people didn't like about what was going on in music in the mid 80s.
Yeah.
With a lot of, you know, the way we were exploring new recording concepts and machines and samples and sequences and all the new things we could do in the studio. And so it was the way we made music was changing drastically, moving from the analog age into the digital age. So we were like all into that. We said, yeah, this is great. We're in, you know, let's, because we, you know, like I said, we were Starship. We had set out with the intention of completely redefining the band at that point in time with Knee Deep in the Hoopla album, stylistically, musically, everything. So, well, it, you know, obviously it worked because We Built This City became a gigantic hit for us.
Yeah.
But I think, and really the, at that point in time, there wasn't that much backlash originally. It sort of started to steamroll or snowball around the time in the late 90s when Blender Magazine did this list of the worst songs ever.
Oh, God.
And which is, I mean, I never really understood that anyway, because why would you even want to make a list of what you deem to be the worst of anything? But so they, of course, they put We Built This City as number one on the list. And I thought, what? And our manager at the time had an interesting comment. You know, he said, well, if you're going to be on a list, be number one. Well, all right. So right. Then a lot of other media picked up on that. And then next thing you know, everybody's making their worst of list, worst guitar solos ever recorded, all this kind of stuff. So that kind of snowballed. And then, you know, people picked up on it. And then going back to, as I mentioned, I think it just became, like I said, so symbolic of what was happening in music, rock music in the 80s, that turned a lot of people off. And then for a band like Starship, the stakes were even higher for us.
Yeah.
Because we were coming out of the Jefferson Starship, which came out of the Jefferson airplane,
right,
which was so symbolic of the countercultural revolutionary days of the 60s and how music was such a big part of the counterculture. So the stakes were higher. So I think that we were perceived to be more of a sellout because of that than a lot of other bands who were maybe taking some of the same musical direction as we were.
In the 80s, yeah, all the bands worked with drum machines and outside writers.
Yeah.
And it was time to be successful. It was time to make money. You guys, yeah, put in a lot of time. So why shouldn't you, you know, reap the rewards? And as far as Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship, and Starship, this group of people, musicians collectively, made their stamp in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. So I just think it's, yeah, a win-win-win all the way around.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, obviously, I'm proud of the song.
Sure.
All I can tell you is today, when we perform the song live, it's the most popular song that we do in the live show. It's the one that gets people immediately, they rise, they stand up, they get out of their seats, yep, as soon as we play that song. And I've never seen one face in the audience go, oh no, not that song again.
Right. Yeah. You can't not play it. If you didn't play it, people would be angry.
And, you know, going back to the inception too of the song, when I brought it into the studio, because to me, what I loved about the song was the lyric and the verse, you know, the great Bernie Taupin who wrote the lyrics.
Yeah.
That's what intrigued me about it. The song, you know, there's a very darker element to that song if you really dissect the words and, you know, what's being said there and what it's truly about. But when we developed that, the chorus was written in the studio after I brought the song in, after I brought the demo in, we created that chorus in the studio, which is what made the song a hit, but it also obscured the other parts of the song, you know, that people never get past the, we built this city,
right,
we built, you know, into maybe you might want to delve into like, you know, say you don't know me, recognize my face, say you don't care who goes to that kind of place, too, right, many runaways eating up the night, you know. And, you know, that was a part of the song that really intrigued me, that dark underbelly, which kind of gets lost now.
Yeah, if someone picked up an acoustic guitar and sang this in a coffee house, people would go like, man, that's deep. You know what I mean?
Hey, have you ever heard Biffy Clyro's version?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say that again.
Have you heard Biffy Clyro's version?
I have not.
The city, check that out.
Because
they do an acoustic. They do an acoustic version of it, which is killer.
Say you don't know me or recognize my face. Say you don't care who goes to that kind of place. In the hoopla, sinking in your fight. Too many runaways eating up the night. Marconi plays a mamba. Listen to the radio. Don't you remember? We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. Built this city.
Well, again, this We Built This City starts a string of, you guys have three number one hits. We Built This City, Sarah, and then in 87, a song that appeared on No Protection, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. And I just, yeah, love that song. I love when Grace comes in the solo part. It's just like,
yeah,
you, it's going up and then Grace comes in and it takes it up again. It's just so great.
Looking in your eyes, I see a paradise. This world that I found is too good
to be true. Standing here beside you, want so much to give you this love in my heart that I'm feeling for you.
Let them see we're crazy. I don't care about that. Put your hand in my hand, baby. Don't ever look back. Let the world around us just fall apart. Baby, we can make it if we're heart to heart. And we can build this dream together. Standing strong forever. Nothing's gonna stop us now. And if this
Yeah, that was our 18-month period there of three number one songs in a span of 18 months was it's just silly when I think about it. But yeah, nothing's going to stop us. So, you know, we got offered the song to do for the movie. And I thought, well, this is kind of cool because it's a bit of a musical departure for Starship. You know, it's got some kind of R&B elements going on in there. It's a good groove thing. And I said, but the perfect guy to produce this has got to be Narda Michael Walden, because he was living in the Bay Area and he was coming off of Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin. And it kind of surprised me really when he said, yeah, I'll do it. We sent him the song and he goes, I'm in, I'll do it. So when we first started cutting it, Grace was singing the first part of the verse, because typically on Starship songs, I would usually, quite often I take the higher stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So she was singing the first part, and then I would come in with a, let them say we're crazy.
Yeah.
But we thought, Narda, he was brilliant. He said, let's flip that. Nice. He says, you start the low part, and then we'll have Grace come in for the higher part. And bingo, that's what made it. You know, that's what, it all came together then.
And when I hear that, that's what I would tell Grace Slick. I'd say, if you don't think you're a good singer, Grace, listen to this. That's
check this out.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Let me ask you about Craig, and I apologize. I've never known how to pronounce Craig's last name.
Chiquiso.
See, I see it written, and I'm going to mess it up. So
he described it to me when I first met him as like Chuck-E-So. Chiquiso. Right. I said, okay, I got it.
So this long-haired, mustache-wearing guitar player on Freedom at Point Zero, he's all in on this pop wave with you guys. He sticks around the whole time.
Yeah.
So he was all in. He was just like, he was game. He was up for it.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Yeah, everybody was on board. You know, sometimes with revisionist history, the way 25, 30 years after the fact, people kind of have a different recollection about what was going on in the moment. And so it kind of tickles me sometimes, because Grace Slick is not always has the most positive remembrances of We Built This City either. I've heard her say some disparaging things about it. Like, I always tell people, like, okay, you know who Grace Slick is. You're familiar with Grace Slick's personality, right? Do you think she'd ever sing a song that she didn't like?
Right.
No, I don't think so.
No, you're not going to.
Everybody was on board, right?
But, yeah, you're not going to make her do it.
Yeah, no.
And the other song in No Protection that I just can't get enough of is It's Not Over Till It's Over. Such a positive anthem. Such just, like, I can play that on a loop. I just love it.
Can't build a dream without a plan.
So. Yeah, great guitar work on that one, you know. Good background vocals. And you're right, you know, real positive, anthemic, you know, we're still standing. This is not over.
Yep, raise your fist.
Yeah.
In 1989, Grace is no longer with the band, but you're still flying the flag high with Love Among the Cannibals. I believe in 89, we also get a Jefferson Airplane album.
Yeah.
So now we got Starship and Jefferson Airplane back, all vying for time on the radio. But you guys got it with It's Not Enough. Great tune.
Yeah, great song. You know, written by, again, Martin Page and Tommy Funderburk. Martin Page, one of my favorite writers, and he was almost like a member of the band. We worked so much with Martin with his songs, and he'd come in and sing background vocals with us quite often. So, it's a Martin Page song, Tommy Funderburk, produced by Mike Shipley, who was the engineer for Def Leppard. And Mike engineered most of the stuff that Mutt Lange was producing during that point in time. So I will tell you that that Mutt Lange's influence is all over it. You know, he was in the studio with us and hanging out a lot and helping to, come up with that atmospheric sound that we had on a lot of the songs on that album, especially on the other one, with a song that Mutt wrote called I Didn't Mean to Stay All Night. His hands are all over that one. So
yeah. Good track. That's a good one, too. Yeah. Wild Again is also on that album.
Yeah.
Ask you this, during this period a lot of singers were leaving bands. Were you ever asked by any bands to join their band? Like, did Journey ever call up and say, Steve's leaving, do you want to be in Journey? I'm just curious, because why not reach out to a Mickey Thomas?
Not at that point in time, or a little bit before that, when we were in the process of making the Knee Deep in the Hoopla album, there was some interest in me possibly joining up with Chicago when Peter Cetera had left Chicago. And I actually flew down to L.A. and met with the guys, and we talked about it. But I was right in the middle of making Knee Deep in the Hoopla, and I was so committed, to that song and to the reinvention of the Starship, the new Starship that we just, been talking about. And so I had to politely decline at that point in time.
Does the band at that time know you're making that trip?
Yes, they did.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? I mean, had there not been anything happening at that point with a new album under the moniker Starship, I think you would have been a great fit for Chicago. I think it would have worked.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. At that point in time, I just didn't think it was the right fit. And as I said, I was so committed to the Starship album. So I don't know. I'd heard that, and I didn't even know this at the time, but I heard that when Toto was first getting together, that I was their first choice before Bobby Kimmel came along.
Yeah.
But they never really reached out to me. That was right about the time that I was, I was still in the Elvin Bishop Band when Toto formed. So
yeah.
Yeah.
These are cool.
But Bobby was a good one though.
Yeah. I love hearing these stories. So after Love Among the Cannibals, basically then you make your living as a touring entity. You can go out.
Yeah.
You can go out with Starship on a package tour or play wherever you want to play. Always people are always going to want to hear this music. But finally, in 2013, you finally get a new studio album out after, what is that, 14, 15 years?
14, Loveless 14 years.
Yeah, Loveless Fascination. Another great album. Now, I know that in 2013, the industry is different. So the super fans really have to seek this out and find it. But it's a great album. And, you know, What Did I Ever Do is a fantastic song. One of the many on the album.
You do have to kind of seek it out. And I've been thinking, you know, this is the 2023 is the 10 year anniversary of the release of that album. So we're toying with the idea of trying to do a re-release of that and try to make a little bit of a splash somehow with that album, because it really is a good album. It's completely overlooked. So we might try to, revisit that and maybe create a social media event with it somehow. I'm toying with that idea right now.
Yeah, it's a hard one to find too. Like if you still like physical media, it's a difficult one to find. But
it's hard to even stream it or anything.
Yeah, you're right. I'm happy to have it. 2021 Greatest Hits relaunched.
Yeah,
explain to me the reasoning to do these re-records.
Well, we re-recorded now those songs that were on that. We actually re-recorded those, I think, around 2002.
Okay, wow.
Is when I re-recorded them, yeah. But then what happens is you do that, and then it's for a certain label, and then maybe years go by, and then that label sells the rights to another label, and then they want to repackage it and reissue it with maybe some new artwork and as their own, you know. So some of the songs get kind of recycled, recirculated in different packages and different formats. And it doesn't really thrill me, but I don't really have a lot of control over that sometimes.
And is the reason, because this is what I always assume the reason is, when you re-record those classic hits, is that so that you can then, if someone wants to use one of those songs in a commercial or something, you would want them to use the new version because the money's better. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay.
Usually, though, people want to use the original recording more often than not. You know, they always sound better, the original recording.
It's, and I'm glad you're saying that. I mean, it's always fun to, and many bands have done it, Journey, Foreigner, Kiss, Blondie, everyone does it. But, and sometimes, you know, it's pretty good, but the original, there's always something just special the about magic. The magic. Unless you're Taylor Swift.
And Taylor, that's a different situation, you know, because she's so much younger and there's not maybe not quite as much time has elapsed from
right. No,
what we did not those much original at all. Recordings to the re-records. Yeah.
All right, Mickey. Let me tell people once again. Out right now, a classic Christmas. It actually comes out December 1st. Get it. Put it in your Christmas playlist. You're gonna love it. It's gonna seem like you've been listening to these two versions your whole life. They're really that good. Go to starshipcontrol.com for everything about Mickey Thomas. I guess 2024, maybe back out on the road with Starship.
Definitely. We'll be on the road. We're hoping to do maybe, 50, 60 shows in 2024. So we'll be out there all over the place, all over the map.
So never going to retire, right, Mickey? You just keep doing this until you can't do it.
I don't have any plans to retire, no. I mean, I feel good. My voice is good. The energy's there. My body's been good to me. My voice has been good to me. I still love it. I love being on stage. I love traveling. I'm just a gypsy at heart because I like to be on the move. No end in sight.
Good. Good to hear. And now, Mickey, the last question is always this one. Of all the songs of your entire career, which song would you like me to use as the playout song for this episode?
Oh, that's a good one. Does it have to be a big hit or
can be anything you want? It could be some deep track that people might not be familiar with. It can be anything.
Wow. How about Healing Waters from Love Among the Cannibals?
You got it. Healing Waters.
All right.
Everybody have a Merry Christmas. Mickey, my best to you and your family, and please enjoy Healing Waters. Thanks, Mickey.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
When all the hope is gone, I'll be there to keep you.
I love it. The Christmas tree all ready to go.
Yeah, man. We've got two or three already up in the house. So
I think after Thanksgiving,
my wife likes to get ahead of the game.
I think after Thanksgiving, you're okay.
Yeah, definitely.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.